The Trump administration unveiled a new immigration policy today, and the new rule, it's complicated.
It's 800 some pages long. I mean, it really is kind of the worst of government.
Also today, an activist leader in Hong Kong vows to continue to stand up to China, whatever the cost.
In a David versus Goliath battle, instead of criticizing on David, we should put more pressure on Goliath, the one suppressed on people's freedom.
And musicians around the world convene in South Africa to create Afrofuturism in the present.
We so often think of Africa as backward, and it's kind of a very revolutionary idea to think of us, I don't know, gone in space. You know, Africans in space, what the devil is that?
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and much more today here on The World. In the old days, like 25 years ago, radio and TV reporters around the globe would produce their stories and then ship them out by plane. Today, at least with the Kashmir story, we're forced to do that again. 8 days ago, India clamped down on all communications in and out of Kashmir. That was a precautionary move taken by the Indian government after it revoked Kashmir's special status guaranteed to the majority Muslim state. The BBC's Yogita LeMay filed a dispatch from Kashmir yesterday, then had it flown to Delhi.
On Friday, mass protests took place in a part of Srinagar in which thousands of people participated. It was filmed by a BBC team. In it, you can see people running to safety. You can hear gunshots being fired. But we aren't able to go to the hospital, being stopped either by angry locals or by security forces. We were, however, able to put a question about it to a government spokesperson.
Are there any casualties in hospital, sir?
You see, the police has already made a detailed statement yesterday about that, that there was absolutely no firing, not a single gunshot was fired, and that is it.
Not much clarity in his answer there, and the Ministry of Home Affairs of the national government has denied claims that any protest larger than 20 people took place in Srinagar.
That was the BBC's Yogita LeMay filing from Kashmir. The tension in Kashmir dates back decades. Wars and conflicts have erupted over the disputed territory. India's nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi was behind the move to remove Kashmir's status last week.
Jammu Kashmir and Ladakh mein.
Here's Modi speaking in Hindi, saying that a new era has begun. As we said earlier, it's been extremely hard to get independent information from Kashmir, but this afternoon we were able to hear directly from there. A few hours ago, we got through to a journalist on the inside.
This is Rahul Pandita reporting from Srinagar in Kashmir Valley.
But we couldn't establish a solid phone connection with Rahul Pandita. So we did the next best thing. We sent him written questions, and he responded in a very 21st century way. He recorded his answers and sent them back to us as voice memos. Pandita says it got a lot harder to move around Kashmir today.
Fearing an untoward incident or clashes with Indian security forces, a very strict curfew was enforced because of the festival of Eid al-Adha. It is a day when Muslim men and women and children come out in large numbers to offer prayer in mosques.
So harder to get to the mosques because Indian authorities prohibited the use of vehicles, but not impossible. People can move around on foot. Pandita says people have also been able to get essential supplies from shops off the main roads, and they're still getting to the mosques.
At 7 a.m. this morning, Indian Standard Time, some of us climbed onto the Shankaracharya Hill, which is a hill formation in the heart of Srinagar. So we could hear the azan from mosques all over the valley. We also saw a large number of people offering their prayers in three mosques, which we could see from that hill formation. Once the prayers were done, then people fearing clashes between, you know, other people and security forces, they preferred to stay indoors.
Rahul Pandita says many Kashmiris are angry with the Indian government's clampdown, but others are uncomfortable voicing their support. He says everyone is nervous, and it's unclear when communications will be back up.
We get a sense from the authorities that mobile network and internet will be down for a long, long time. Though in the next few days, there might be some concession on landline phones. The main reason why mobile networks will remain shut down is because the Indian authorities fear that the terrorist organizations like Hizbul Mujahideen, Lashkar-e-Toyba, and Jaish-e-Mohammed. These are Pakistan-based terrorist organizations. They think that ground workers will use these networks, WhatsApp calls, WhatsApp messages, to incite people into violence.
That was journalist Rahul Pandita in Kashmir. The Kashmir conflict made it to Los Angeles over the weekend at BeautyCon.
You're encouraging nuclear war against Pakistan. There's no winner in this. As a Pakistani, millions of people like me have supported you in your business.
That was Aisha Malik. She was attending BeautyCon as a social media influencer. She's Pakistani. BeautyCon, it's what it sounds like, a convention for movers and shakers in makeup, hair, and skin beauty. Malik was addressing the Indian movie star Priyanka Chopra, who was on stage, and asked her about a tweet she wrote in February when tensions were high between India and Pakistan. The Bollywood celebrity had expressed her pro-India sentiments. Bodyguards rushed to take the microphone away from the Pakistani woman. Here's the Indian actress's response to her.
I have many, many friends from Pakistan, and I am from India. And war is not something that I'm really fond of, but I am patriotic.
I asked Aisha Malik what bothered her about Chopra's tweet from months ago.
Jai Hind is a statement that seems like God bless America.
Right, that's what Chopra said, Jai Hind. That essentially means what? How would you translate that?
Hail India.
Hail India, okay.
And then Pakistan has their own saying. Pakistan is Zindabad, which is long live Pakistan. And those might seem like random sayings, but on that particular day, it wasn't, because it was the highest tensions that we've ever had between our two countries. On that day, we were getting messages from my family saying, we have to get shelter, we got to get water, we need to run because the nukes may be dropping now and we're scared and we're just going to let you know what's going on. And then I get onto Twitter and that's the first thing I see.
Aren't you worried that you might divide Pakistanis, Indians, and Kashmiris further with comments like the ones you made?
Well, the mic was taken from me, so I couldn't continue. I'm upset with also Pakistanis who might be egging on the war, because on that day there were Pakistanis saying or tweeting out, Pakistan's Zindabad. But the difference between those random citizens that were tweeting that and Priyanka Chopra is that she's a global star, and she's more than just a Bollywood star. She's Mrs. Jonas. She's been in Baywatch. She has her own ABC show, and she has this international platform, and people are going to look at her for influence.
What did you think of Chopra's response to you when she said, I'm not a fan of war, but I am patriotic?
That was a cop-out for sure, because she is the UN ambassador for peace, and you should never, ever be fond of war of any sort, not even 1%. You should be totally against war.
How did you feel when she started speaking?
It was upsetting, for sure, yeah.
And why?
She's been in 50 Bollywood films. She's been invited into my home, essentially. She's been somebody that I trusted. And I know I'm speaking on behalf of millions of Pakistanis, because even though we're both from different countries at the end of the day, we look the same, we talk the same, we eat the same food, we watch the same movies, and I feel a connection to them. The outfit I was wearing was actually a sari at the time, which is not the national dress of Pakistan. It's an Indian outfit. But I wear it as if it's one of my own.
Aisha, are you surprised that this exchange went viral? And did it help to at least raise the awareness of what's happening in Kashmir and what's at stake there?
Yeah. As long as I could remember, Kashmir has always been an issue. And I've never heard anybody else talk about it except for Pakistanis and Indians and Kashmiris. And I feel like, even though this was low-key kind of embarrassing for me, because I was emotional and it was very unscripted, one good thing that came out about it is that there's headlines out there now talking about Kashmir.
Aisha Malik is a beauty influencer originally from Pakistan. She was speaking with us from L.A., where she attended BeautyCon and confronted Indian celebrity Priyanka Chopra with thoughts about the situation in Kashmir. There are just over 400 North Atlantic right whales left in the world. And since the beginning of June, 8 have been found dead in Canada's Gulf of St. Lawrence. The endangered species seems to have a new preference for hanging out in one of North America's major shipping lanes. And researchers say ship strikes are often to blame for the recent whale deaths. Reporter Eve Zukoff from WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, has been looking into this.
At the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown, Christy Hodak is leaning over a microscope looking at a water sample. With one hand, she's pressing the buttons on an electronic counter. She's a researcher in the Right Whale Ecology Program, and she's counting and categorizing different kinds of plankton.
Right whales love specific types of plankton, which are called copepods. They are more of a crustacean plankton, which is, think of crabs or shrimp.
For decades, right whales spent their summers in Canadian waters like the Bay of Fundy and the Roseway Basin, feasting on these copepods. But copepod numbers in those places have fallen in recent years.
And so they left those areas because it just was not a rich source of food for them when they needed it.
In 2017, researchers discovered North Atlantic right whales congregating further north in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, a place they'd hardly ever been seen. It's an area that just happens to have highly trafficked shipping lanes. Sean Brilliant, a biologist with the Canadian Wildlife Federation, says there's an underlying cause putting whales in harm's way.
Climate change is almost definitely responsible for the change in distribution of the whales.
That's because the copepods are thriving in cooler waters further north, as the Bay of Fundy and Roseway Basin have gotten too warm for them. And Brilliant says for the whales,
I think that they're still sort of settling out and figuring out how they're going to use the Gulf and where the best food is. And of course, there's a lot of variability from year to year, and this makes it very challenging for managing our human activities.
That first year they were found in the Gulf of St. Lawrence was a disastrous one for the whales. 12 were found dead from ship strikes and entanglements. In response, the Canadian government introduced new regulations to try to protect the whales, imposing temporary speed restrictions in areas where they were spotted.
They actually enacted in 2018 really nice mitigation measures that seemed to help the whales fare a little bit better because there were no deaths in Canadian waters last year.
That's Sarah Sharp, a veterinarian with the International Fund for Animal Welfare. But this summer, 8 of the whales have died. Sharp says this year has been so deadly for 2 reasons. First, all of this is new.
One of the big failures, unfortunately, this year was that the whales were just in a different place than where they had been in previous years. And so what they had set up in terms of protections didn't apply because that's not where the whales were.
They're showing up just a little east, probably in search of food. And it's put them smack in the middle of shipping lanes. The second reason for the spike in death, say whale advocates, has to do with the Canadian government's response. Erica Fuller, a lawyer with the Conservation Law Foundation, says Canadian authorities rolled back some of those 2018 speed restrictions. In some areas, speed limits only applied after a whale was seen.
The problem was that the weather had been bad all through June, and the survey effort was less than it was the summer of 2018. So in the absence of sighting a whale, the triggers often didn't get triggered.
The combination has led to another devastating year for North Atlantic right whale deaths. Early in July, the Canadian government responded by introducing more seasonal regulations on speed and added funding for surveillance. That slowdown on marine traffic was recently lifted. Speed restrictions can be hard on the shipping industry, but Erica Fuller says that's the sacrifice we have to make to save this species from extinction.
It may take slightly longer to get a product to port than it would in the absence of right whales. But we can't lose any more whales to get hit by a ship.
And there's one more question. With rising ocean temperatures, will right whales again chase their favorite food into new waters, perhaps into the path of even greater danger? With a population of just over 400, the answer could be the difference between survival and extinction. For the world, I'm Eve Zukoff.
Just ahead on the show, the Trump administration puts new restrictions on legal immigration. You're listening to The World.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. you'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Today, the Trump administration issued a new rule designed to sharply restrict legal permanent residency, better known as green cards, to immigrants who receive public assistance. That's things like using food stamps or housing assistance. The new regulation is being called the Public Charge Rule.
Through the Public Charge Rule, President Trump's administration is reinforcing the ideals of self-sufficiency and personal responsibility.
That was Ken Cuccinelli, the acting U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Director, announcing the new rule earlier today. It's already led to concern and confusion. Randy Capps is with the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, and according to him, there could be a widening number of immigrants who won't be able to settle permanently and legally in the U.S.
This prediction into the future they call totality of circumstances is a very broad test. And it has a large number of factors in the rule, like education. Does the immigrant have a high school degree? Do they speak English well? And basically, the immigration officer gets to weigh these different things to decide if that person is likely to use benefits in the future. So it's not the use of benefits that's going to exclude people. It's their possible use in the future.
So what is the point of this plan?
The point of this plan, according to the administration, is really twofold. It's, as Acting Secretary Cuccinelli said today, immigrants should be self-sufficient. And that means two things. They shouldn't be using public benefits in the U.S., and those that might be likely to use public benefits shouldn't come. That means the goals are to reduce the use of public benefits in immigrant families and to reduce the number of poor, likely to use public benefit immigrants that come in.
You know, it strikes me that from the administration's perspective, this is exactly what they want. I mean, why should people coming to this country not be admitted based on education, for example?
Well, right now, education is not a qualification in immigration law as to who gets into the country. Neither is English language. I mean, they're not written into the law as criteria for admission. The criteria for admission are primarily based on family connections and in some cases based on refugee or asylum status or having a job in the United States. If this administration, the Congress, could work together to reform the immigration system and make education and English proficiency a criteria for getting into the United States, that would be fine. But they haven't done that. They're doing this in a backdoor way through a regulation instead.
Do you think this is going to be challenged in the courts and how, I mean, on what grounds?
It's not clear from the rule exactly how an immigration officer is supposed to weigh all of these negative and positive factors. It's just the most complex set of immigration regulations that I've seen, or one of the most complex. I mean, it's 800-some pages long. I mean, it really is kind of the worst of government. It's broad and it's vague. And I think that makes it subject to discretion on the part of individual officers, that makes it subject to potential discrimination against people from certain parts of the world. So until we know exactly what instructions the officers are going to be given on how they implement this, it's really ripe for abuse. And I think that's probably where the lawsuits would be headed.
So finally, Randy, just lay it out for us. Who will this primarily affect?
Yeah, so when we look at the numbers in terms of recent green card holders who would likely not have been able to get into the country because they had a negative factor on this rule, far higher numbers of people from Mexico and Central America would likely be excluded, far lower from Europe, with Africa and Asia being somewhere in between.
Randy Capps with the Migration Policy Institute speaking with us from Washington. Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks so much for having me on.
Hong Kong has the eighth busiest airport in the world, but today it was closed to passenger flights because protesters are occupying terminal buildings.
Do you hear the people sing, sing the song of
That's a song of French revolutionaries in the musical Les Misérables, which has become an unofficial anthem for Hong Kong's protesters. Since March, protesters have been demanding the scrapping of a law that would allow extradition to mainland China. Today's airport protest was peaceful, but Sunday saw widespread violence between activists and police, like here at the Taikoo subway station. Hong Kong police say they only respond with force when attacked with deadly force like slings and gasoline bombs. Officials in Beijing said today that for the first time they are seeing what they are calling sprouts of terrorism. Chinese armed police are reported to be gathering across the border in Shenzhen in mainland China. Joshua Wong is a leading activist in Hong Kong. He says the airport there is still occupied.
We gather at Hong Kong International Airport because people are really angry on how police have fired bullets horizontally and headshot one young female protester, which result in permanent blindness. And it's just trigger more people continue the fights.
Was that actual ammunition or was it rubber bullets?
That's the rubber bullet.
But how long can these demonstrations go on? I mean, there has been a lot of disruption at the airport, flights canceled, flights unable to come in. How long can you persist?
Protests continue on every weekend, and we will show the power of people. And we just hope to be the one can determine our own destiny instead of being manipulated by Beijing.
It really feels like the protesters have pushed well beyond getting this extradition law shelved. So what are you fighting for right now?
In fact, the extradition bill is not shelved yet. It still exists on the legislative program. Our short-term goal is to urge government to terminate the bill. Our long-term goal is show our cause for free election. We are just asking for the fundamental right to elect our own government, the right enjoyed by lots of Western country people since last century.
Chinese officials are now talking about sprouts of terrorism, which seems kind of eerie. How worried are you about an even more violent crackdown?
State terrorism was experienced by Hong Kong ordinary protesters, and we will continue our fight, and we hope to encourage people to be our allies and not to keep silence.
You'll encourage the fight even if it results in more violence.
In a David versus Goliath battle, instead of criticizing on David, we should put more pressure on Goliath, the one suppressed on people's freedom. And that's why I will be part of it and we continue our fight.
Joshua Wong, what will you do if Chinese armed forces come into Hong Kong proper?
We urge people to continue their peaceful protests in different way. If they send PLA to Hong Kong, it will just damage Hong Kong economy. I don't believe they have enough capacity to face backfire from business communities.
But are peaceful protests viable if those protesters are facing Chinese police who are well armed?
The crackdown on human rights is crystal clear, and we will never back down and surrender.
Activist Joshua Wong speaking with us from Hong Kong. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Again.
Thank you.
News headlines are coming up in about a minute. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. The face of evangelical Christianity in America is changing.
The Bible teaches that Christ died for the world. The Brazilian, the Venezuelan, the Vietnamese, the Cambodian, the Russian, the... And we have over 25 nations here.
An Orlando megachurch opens its doors, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRX, and PRI. When you hear the term evangelical Christian, you might think immediately white, conservative, Republican. There's a good reason for that. White evangelicals have been a pretty consistent conservative voting bloc in this country going back to the 1980s. It turns out, though, that's not the whole story.
I say, hey, I'm Latino. And they were like, oh, he must be a Democrat. He's Hispanic. Oh, I'm evangelical. They were like, oh, they're a Republican. Well, guess what? I'm Hispanic and evangelical. Wow. Work it out. I'm both and.
That's one voice from our series this week about how evangelical Christianity in America is changing. The World's Matthew Bell co-reported the series with religion scholar Heather Melquist-Leto, who's at the University of Hawaii. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi, Marco.
So we just heard from one of the evangelicals we'll meet this week. What did you set out to do with this series of stories?
As you mentioned, Marco, evangelicals are often thought of as a voting bloc, but this is a really big swath of the American population. About one in four Americans identify as Protestant evangelical. In some parts of the country, it's much, much higher, but religious affiliation, demographics, of course, of the country are changing, and so is the face of evangelical Christianity. And as we just heard from that guy a second ago, there's an assumption maybe that evangelicals are indeed all white and American-born and they vote Republican. But for this series, we wanted to highlight some evangelical voices that you might find surprising. They're from people who reflect, I think, a more diverse future of the church.
So, Heather, you study global Christianity. Let's get our head around the language here. What exactly are we talking about when we use the word evangelical?
You know, what defines evangelical Christianity has shifted throughout history, but we can maybe highlight some common traits. Often evangelicals talk about having a born-again conversion experience. They go to church regularly. They place a great importance on the Bible as the Word of God. And importantly, they have an interest in engaging with the larger culture outside of the church. The majority of evangelicals in America today are white. Like you said, about 75%, but much less attention has been given to non-whites and immigrants who account for the other 25%, and they make up a larger and larger portion of American evangelicals today. Latinos, for example, you might not know, are the single fastest growing group of evangelicals.
And so, with that in mind, Marco, we begin our series in Orlando. Sunday service at Calvario City Church is impressive. There's an enormous stage with a full choir, a professional electric band, giant TV screens, thundering sound system, even a smoke machine.
The scene is pretty typical of evangelical megachurches, which are known for putting on such multi-sensory experiences. The space holds about 4,000 people, and this morning it's mostly full. But what really strikes me here is the diversity. Sunday services here are in English and Spanish, but not everyone is Latino. And looking around, I see young and old, black, brown, and white people, men and women. Some folks are dressed up, but others are fairly dressed down.
This is a real draw for people here, and something we heard from members of the congregation, like Marta Martinez. She grew up in Puerto Rico, moved to Orlando, and started coming to Calvario City Church in the early 1990s.
I'm Puerto Rican and was born and raised in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rican means mixes of races. So in my family, there are black people, there are white people. You see my eyes?
Your eyes are green?
They change color. They are blue, green.
Blue, green.
Sometimes, but my great-grandmothers and their great-grandmother, they came from Europe. So everybody's mixed together. So we don't have that issue of, because you're dark or because you're white or because you're... We don't care about color. We love each other. That's the way it is.
Greet three people and say, you look absolutely marvelous.
Bienvenido a Calvario City Church.
Welcome to Calvario City Church.
Pastors Gabriel and Jeanette Salguero are a dynamic duo. The married couple is from New York City. They moved here 3.5 years ago to be part of one of the biggest Latino-led megachurches in Florida.
The Salgueros move back and forth across the stage together as they're preaching. Jeanette translates for Gabriel from Spanish into English, but sometimes they really play around with each other's translations to the delight of all of the bilingual worshipers. On this morning, they're pulling the congregation into a sermon based on the Book of Ruth.
There is an
impressive person,
y es una mujer.
And she's a woman!
The Salgueros can also bring some real rhetorical heat.
El Dios nuestro camina con nosotros.
Walks with us.
Aunque ande,
although you may walk through the valley of shadow.
Toward the end of the sermon, Gabriel and Jeanette mentioned the motto of Calvario City Church. Their vision is not just to build a great church, they say. It's about building a great city, one life at a time. That's the motto. But what does that really mean? What sort of city on a hill do the Salgueros have in mind?
They definitely have a broad sense of what city means here. Calvario City Church is a church with campuses not just in Orlando, but also in New York City and in Puerto Rico. Gabriel has served on White House advisory councils and has led prayers at the Democratic National Convention. Gabriel and Jeanette are also the co-founders of the National Latino Evangelical Coalition, which represents the fastest-growing group of evangelicals in America.
The label evangelical is one that the Salgueros fully embrace. It's a big part of who they are. So when we sit down to talk to them after Sunday service, we ask Gabriel for a definition of what evangelicals believe.
They have a high view of Scripture. They believe in Christ as the only Savior, so they have this evangelistic, they proselytize. They believe in eternal life. And evangelical comes from euangelion, the Greek, which is to share the good news. So we're committed to the gospel of Christ in a way that transforms society.
How did he do with that?
He did wonderful. He forgot to say that evangelicals are not a monolith.
Jeanette is pointing out something crucial here. When you start to ask evangelical Christians exactly how they should transform society or where to even begin, that's when you hear a lot of different answers.
Here was a telling moment for the Salgueros. Soon after they arrived in Orlando, in June 2016, tragedy hit this city.
We begin with that horrifying news breaking overnight in Florida, what appears to be the deadliest terror attack on American soil since 9/11.
It happened only a few miles from the church on Latin night at a gay nightclub called Pulse. 49 people were killed in that shooting attack. Nearly all of them were Hispanic. When a memorial service was held in a city park, Pastor Gabriel did something that most evangelical leaders would not have done. He went to the memorial and spoke at the vigil.
It was in the town square where it was like the day after, the Monday after or something like that. And they asked me and a couple of other pastors to pray. And one of the young men, Latino, came afterwards. He's gay. He says to me, "What are you doing here? You watch on television. What are you doing here?" I said, "I'm here because I think Jesus would be here."
The Salgueros say that the Bible does not condone homosexuality or gay marriage. And that's pretty common among evangelicals. But despite those beliefs, Gabriel and Jeanette say they had a Christian duty to support the Pulse victims and their families. So when relatives of one of the victims said that they needed a large church to hold a funeral service, Calvario opened its doors.
This is something that many evangelicals would have trouble with. But Gabriel says no one should be surprised about his decision. Just because he doesn't agree with people on certain issues doesn't mean they're not welcome at his church. He says people who disagree need to talk with each other.
The challenge in America today is on very delicate issues. We collapse things to a simplistic form, whereas we assume that LGBTQ communities don't have evangelical relatives. These conversations are happening all the time. Regrettably, it's during these crises that they get attention, that finally people feel that it's courageous. But people should be courageous every day to have these boundary-crossing conversations.
Salguero says he hopes that his church is an example, ready to engage with people from a variety of backgrounds.
Jeanette Salguero, who's also the chief operating officer at Calvario, says working with immigrants and refugees is a top priority, even if it's not a popular move with some evangelicals on the religious right.
We do serve a huge refugee community here, and they're very important to us, and we will serve them as if they are our own. And that's who I am as a pastor. That's who this church is as a church within the community.
For the Salgueros, the message of the gospel transcends politics, even national borders. It's something Gabriel preaches about from the pulpit. And he tells us that he worries about the rise of nationalism he sees in American Christianity.
If we're Christians, the Bible teaches that Christ died for the world. The Brazilian, the Venezuelan, the Vietnamese, the Cambodian, the Russian, and we have over 25 nations here at Calvary City Church. We recognize that Christ died for us all and resurrected for us all. And so, yes, love your country. But no country is better than any other country in the sight of God.
Many Americans live increasingly in social bubbles based on age, race, gender, politics, and so on. But the Salgueiros are trying to do something different. I asked Gabriel directly why he thinks his congregation is able to maintain such internal diversity.
I'm not trying to make everyone me. The gospel doesn't homogenize you. The gospel unifies you while welcoming your diversity. And I think that balance of the gospel, where we seek justice and reconciliation while respecting people where they come from, makes them feel at home.
More than one person at Calvario City Church tells us that they feel at home here, even if they share that home with 4,000 other people. There's something for everybody. Multiple languages, lots of different ministries to get involved with, from local education to a walk-in medical center to overseas missions. As for the political divide in America, it feels like the Salgueiros are standing right across that fault line. Unlike many white evangelicals, they are not among the preachers who openly embrace the politics of Donald Trump's Republican Party. At the same time, they're not exactly political progressives either. Gabriel says people shouldn't make assumptions about evangelical political allegiances.
We have Democrats, Republicans, independents like me. I'm not affiliated with any party. And so in our church, we have a great diversity of political thought. I think evangelicalism in America has a great diversity of political thought, especially when you begin to dig deeper into racial cultural diversity in evangelicalism.
To be clear, Gabriel and Jeanette say they don't shy away from politically controversial subjects when they're preaching, and they will take positions on some issues. But one thing they say they do not do is tell people who to vote for.
This comes partly from their respect for the separation of church and state, but it's also because they know that Latinos in their congregation, in particular, are all over the map politically. They may be against abortion, but they're also against the death penalty, and they're in favor of humane immigration policies. So all of this means that in the coming election cycle, it's worth paying close attention to the fastest-growing group of American evangelicals.
Calvario City Church, with a multi-ethnic congregation led by Latino pastors, is an example of how megachurches in America are changing. Tomorrow, we meet one of the founders of a church in San Francisco doing something radically different. They decided the megachurch model was not their real calling.
They don't have paid pastors or even church buildings. They gather in people's houses.
I want to change the way that the American church thinks about the church.
That story tomorrow. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
And I'm Heather Melquist-Leto.
Our series this week on evangelical Christianity is a collaboration with the Sacred Rites Project at Northeastern University and funded by the Henry Luce Foundation. Okay, call this sacred in spirit, secular in sound. Sufi Muslim singers from West Africa duetting with Christian gospel singers from the American South. From Mali, a husband and wife duo, Amadou and Mariam. From the U.S., the gospel group, The Blind Boys of Alabama. The song is called Bamako to Birmingham, two faraway capitals brought together in song. Blind Boys of Alabama recorded their part at home in, as the title suggests, Birmingham. Amadou and Mariam added their voices in Bamako. Even though they weren't in the same studio for these sessions, they are now a septet on the road performing the summer in Europe. Bamako to Birmingham, new music from Amadou and Mariam, along with the Blind Boys of Alabama. You're listening to The World. We've been talking a lot about the tension between China and Hong Kong. Pro-democracy protests have entered their 10th straight week in Hong Kong, and neither side appears to be backing down. Fair to say, sensitivities are running high on both sides. Now sashaying into this fraught situation, Western fashion. Versace, Givenchy, and Coach have inadvertently become points of conflict by releasing some T-shirts. You know those concert T-shirts with the name of the band on the front and all the tour stops on the back? The designer T-shirts in question look like that. The back has names of all the cities where the designers have boutiques. So in the case of Versace, the T-shirt says Milan, Italy, Berlin, Germany, Tokyo, Japan, and Hong Kong, Hong Kong, and Macau, Macau. And that's a problem because both are part of China. So the Chinese would have insisted on Hong Kong, China, and Macau, China. The Chinese backlash has been dramatic and swift. Consumers in China have called for boycotts. The Chinese actress Yang Mi, the Versace brand ambassador in China, pulled out of her contract. She was just the first. Jackson Yi, you know, Yi of the Chinese pop sensation the TFBoys, he's also a fashion ambassador, or was. He also backed out of his contract with Givenchy. That's an early TFBoys hit. You're welcome. The companies have all issued apologies on social media, like this one. Coach respects and supports China's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Perhaps more a political statement than a Twitter post from a fashion brand, making the whole thing one big fashion faux pas. Okay, who doesn't like a good surprise?
I mean, everything is surprising. It's like it's a constant surprise. In the best possible way.
That's Nick Zinner, guitarist of the band Yeah Yeah Yeahs, and the surprise and wonder he's referring to there happened to him in South Africa, a music recording project called Africa Express that stopped recently for its latest edition in Johannesburg. It drew artists from all over the world and from South Africa, like singer Zolani Mahola from Cape Town of the band Freshly Ground.
I tried to go in without any expectations. I kind of just expected to have fun.
This is the kind of style these 40-some-odd musicians gravitated to. It's called Afrofuturism. What is your understanding of Afrofuturism? What is it?
I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer that question.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
It's kind of us transporting ourselves into dimensions that we don't really know yet, but that we just kind of, we're projecting ourselves. We so often think of Africa as backward, and it's kind of a very revolutionary idea to think of us, I don't know, gone in space, you know, and what does that feel like? What does that mean? You know, Africans in space, what the devil is that?
So musically, what is Afrofuturism?
Musically, I don't know what that exactly translates to. Maybe it's a whole lot of electronic sounds. Something that feels quintessentially African, but that is far, far away.
The Africa Express project is the brainchild of Damon Albarn of the British band Blur. Nick Zinner has been part of previous iterations of Africa Express, like the one Albarn undertook a few years ago in Bamako, the dusty capital of Mali in West Africa. The South Africa edition took the global collaboration format, plugged it in, and really let the magic happen, but this time with virtually zero direction. Nick Zinner and Zolani Mahola recall.
So it was kind of like a surreal summer camp situation where we were all in this kind of like 80s-ish resort just outside of Johannesburg. And in the resort was like, I'm going to say 20 to 25, maybe 30 little huts, like proper thatched huts.
And in all of these huts, people would just be sort of just in there making music.
And every hut was a studio. Wow. And there's maybe 40 to 50 people kind of mulling about, going from hut to hut.
And you could go in to any hut and go and, you know, chat someone up and say, do you want to make some music together?
It's like sometimes you don't even know each other's name, but it's like, I know you play guitar and you make beats, and let's just hang out and try to find something that works. And all the people I worked with and were there were extremely open and kind and full of just fantastic ideas.
That was really, really a wonderful way to work. Together,
open and innovative collaboration, the big dividend from Africa Express. It was summer last January when the artists converged on Johannesburg. The Rap Party, says Nick Zinner, was unforgettable. It just echoed the spontaneity and the improvisation of the whole 10 days.
On the last or the second to last day, there was a playback of all the material that had been done by everyone. And there's probably like 50 tracks. It was like a proper like 3-hour playback. And, you know, everybody who worked on tracks was there, you know, including a lot of musicians from Johannesburg who would just kind of like come in and hang out and collaborate. So there's, you know, 50 or 60 people there kind of around this weird hotel pool area with palm trees. And it just turned into like the sickest dance party.
That alone would make any artist want to be a part of Africa Express. I asked Nick Zinner why the project keeps pulling him back in.
Because I'm seeing and hearing so much incredible music from different parts of the world. It's like I want to learn that. I want to, you know, I'm constantly seeking inspiration and just trying to find that feeling of really just being alive through music.
This is our stop. Time to get off the Africa Express. The world's theme music was composed by Ned Porter. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.